This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello, and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and today's episode is all about seven worlds, one planet. Because we are joined today, I'm delighted to say, by producer, director.
Both. Well done.
Thanks.
Producer, director.
Of things like Frozen Planet, Planet Earth 2, and Seven Worlds, One Planet.
Yeah.
Chad and Hunter, welcome back to The Cosmic Show.
Thanks so much. Good to be back.
And I will come back to you in a sec, because we are not alone.
And
there is life out
there.
We are, and I'm almost as delighted to say that.
Oh, thanks, I'll take that.
To say that we are joined by Emma Brisdian, who is, as you all know, host of the For What It's Earth podcast.
Yes, indeed. Not quite as an impressive a CV as yours, Chadden, but we'll get there.
Oh, wow. Getting the message out.
You've been on this Cosmic Shed before, but not in the Cosmic Shed.
I've done a remote interview for the Shed, haven't I?
Where were you?
I was in Sweden.
Nice. You were in the Arctic, weren't you?
I mean, technically, I was well above the Arctic Circle, but when you tell people you're in the Arctic, they imagine, you know, glaciers and icebergs and polar bears, and there was none of those in sight. But I was at the very top of Sweden.
You're in a nice hotel.
I was at a climate change research centre, which, yeah, not quite the luxury of a hotel, but definitely a step above camping. No, it was good. It was nice out there. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I know. It looked amazing. And you can go back and listen to that episode, which was bizarrely an Apollo 50th anniversary episode.
Yes.
I managed to shoehorn that in somehow. It was all about exploration, the spirit of exploration.
Yes, yeah. You had me on with two very, very cool guests, and I was just kind of chipping in from Sweden in the corner.
Nice.
Nonsense. It was three very cool guests, and me chipping in from a shed.
It's funny you mentioned Apollo, because it's such a chilly night tonight that being in the shed tonight reminds me of that scene. And is it Apollo 13, where they go around the dark side of the moon and they're all absolutely shivering in the canister?
Yeah.
Because we feel like we're in a little bit of a spaceship here. That's what I love about the Cosmic Shed. You feel like you are floating through space.
Yes.
I love the way you can't kind of see the edges. It really does feel quite cosmic to me. I feel like it's the closest thing to a TARDIS in Bristol.
You don't lean on any of the walls. You might just fall through into some kind of other dimension.
Is it actually a TARDIS in Lyra's playground? The school that she goes to has got a TARDIS.
No way.
Really?
Is that why you drive a 2-hour day to get there?
That's why we bought this house near that.
Yeah, school in Swansea. But
really,
you must go to the TARDIS school.
Yeah.
But it's very chilly inside the spaceship.
It's incredibly chilly.
We're all
chilly.
Rugged up with hats and gloves.
Yeah.
And
you're going to have to edit out some teeth chattering towards the end, I think.
And also, it's a very lovely starry night outside the shed tonight, which is a good thing.
Orion's belt is out.
Yeah, and Betelgeuse, or Betelgeuse, I don't know how you say that, is dimmer than it should be. So Betelgeuse, is, I always think of it as Orion's head, but technically it's his shoulder, apparently, is dimmer than it has been for a long time. And that could be because it's about to go supernova.
Wow.
Which would be amazing. Or it could be just because it is a variable star and dims.
Batteries are winding down.
Yeah, exactly.
It's quite a fun fact.
It's quite good, isn't it? Mm. So if we may go out of the shed today, tonight, and see an exploded star. But also it might be 100,000 years from now. We should get to the topic of the conversation today, which is, of course, Seven Worlds, One Planet. It is wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, we try.
Yeah, I was looking at some reviews earlier, just to see whether I was right that it is wonderful. And it's 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know that.
Which is, I think, as good as it gets.
That is interesting. I wonder when that came out, because just recently, we just got back from the US where we're launching in the US right now. Only one episode's gone out, but the New York Times gave it a fairly interesting review where it felt like the reviewer was starting to become oversaturated with wildlife films. He was referring to the recent Our Planet series on Netflix and referring to, I guess, the frequency that we come back to viewers with these big Attenborough shows these days. Mm. He wasn't really, you know, precisely saying that he didn't like the quality of the series, but it was an interesting review. It was quite, we talk about it in the industry all the time, you know, are we pumping out too many of these bigger, big...
Do you think you are?
It's a tough one. We call them landmarks in television, but to mark, you know, the word landmark means that you mark the landscape with something. That's what I imagine it. And it used to be that every 4 years we would come back with Attenborough, the team that made Blue Planet, the original, or the team that made Trials of Life or Life on Earth. It would be another 4 years before that team could put out another show, and there's nothing in between. And so it felt like it marked the landscape, and we called them landmarks. And then a few years ago, the BBC decided that they were doing so well, they wanted one a year. So now every Christmas, we have one just before Christmas with Attenborough on it. That started around the time of Frozen Planet. We then went to Africa and Life Story and The Hunt and Planet Earth 2 and Blue Planet 2 and now Seven Worlds. And so that frequency of one a year, I do sometimes worry whether viewers will start saying, wow, okay, you know, these big Attenborough blockbusters, we like them, but... You know, we're starting to see the same animals, starting to see the same stories. It's harder and harder to raise the bar. You know, our viewers, it's amazing with viewers when you do give them quality, how that seeps into your head and that's what you expect.
Mm.
And then viewers, that's their baseline. So to raise it next year is like, oh my God, what are we doing? But anyway,
and
long answer, but it's a really interesting point in wildlife filmmaking. It's just, there's more volume being made than ever before. Bristol is absolutely booming. Because some of your listeners might know, but Bristol is the Hollywood of wildlife filmmaking on the planet. Mm. There's no other town on Earth that makes anywhere near the volume of wildlife films as here. Mm. And even now that the big streaming giants like the Netflix and Apple and Amazon, we call them fangs. Have you ever heard this expression?
No.
The BBC is always worried about the fangs coming to get us, which is Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix and Google.
Oh, I like that a lot.
And so the streaming fangs basically decided that, why are we paying the BBC every time we show someone hits on planet Earth? Why don't we make our own? And so, of course, they have got mega checkbooks.
Mm.
So now the streaming giants are all saying, well, we just want to own our own Blue Planet and our own planet Earth. And so there's this race on for everyone to basically replicate them and make them themselves. And so Bristol is awash with independent production companies springing up. We can't find enough staff. People are being headhunted left, right and centre. And you'll find that, yeah, it's just such a popular genre to fill a streaming service because it travels well. It doesn't age that much. It's family friendly. You can change language on it very easily because there's no actors in it. So it's got all these really, they're really, really good cash cows, even though they cost a bit to make. So that's the background behind the gold rush in wildlife filmmaking at the moment.
Yeah. So
if anybody wants a job in wildlife filmmaking, we are desperate.
Yeah, come to
me. Just slide you my card.
Yeah.
do they have to do the masters or can they just go straight in?
Oh, well, it depends on your skills. I mean, if you show the right mindset... you know, I like to say you can't really educate your way into wildlife filmmaking. You have to just live it and breathe it.
Yeah.
I sometimes compare it to saying you want to be a musician or an artist and me saying, oh, what do you paint? And then you saying, well, I'm waiting for someone to give me a job as an artist and then I'll start painting.
Yeah.
Or a musician. It's like, well, unless you're playing your guitar in your bedroom day in, day out as a hobby, then you don't have the passion to make it. So if I meet some kid who's, every weekend he's out in the park with his binoculars because he just loves the ducks in the local park, or he's trying to make a video on his phone of him and his mate skateboarding. It doesn't matter. But if you're living it and breathing it, then that will be the kind of thing that would be impressive and get you in. There's no amount of kind of waiting for... You'll never see the jobs advertised. It's just a matter of people who have that passion to do it anyway.
Yeah, just tweet you a video.
Well, it'd be better than tweeting me your CV.
Yeah. We were chatting the other day. And you were saying that quite a lot of your recruits come from the masters in wildlife filmmaking at UWE.
Yes, that is true. That is a real hotbed of talent there. But most of those kids who've gotten into that degree have gotten into the masters at UWE in wildlife filmmaking because they've shown Nous and Initiative, and you know most of them are quite talented anyway to kind of get into that course. But we do find that they're lucky that that is in Bristol. And so they're right on the doorstep of the BBC and the other production companies that are making wildlife films. There's similar courses in Salford and New Zealand and you name it. But this is a very weird industry in that wildlife filmmaking is so centralised into this one town.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre. I mean, I can't go and be a wildlife filmmaker in 90% of the planet because they just aren't being made there. So the Bristol UWE students doing that wildlife filmmaking course, they're on the doorstep of the right people. And yeah, we've got some fantastic recruits from there.
That's good. Thanks for selling my job.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah,
roll up. But roll up to him first.
It's funny. It's quite a funny thing to start with, actually, because I was trying to be positive, and then you picked up on the New York.
Well, yeah. I thought, well, you know, why not? You know, make it interesting, kind of warts and all.
Yeah.
Do you find that you get like the similar or very different responses across the pond to the same content?
It does vary. It does vary. I mean, all of our big series obviously go air in the US a few weeks later, a few months later. Some of our biggest hits haven't been that great over there. Really? Sometimes it's to do with either politics or, as an example, Frozen Planet was a huge hit in the UK. Mm. When we aired it in the US, it happened to be in March over there after one of the longest, snowiest, coldest, most miserable winters they'd ever experienced. Yeah. And the March Sunday that they started airing it over there on Discovery happened to be the first sunny, warm day of the entire year. And so people went to the parks, they put on barbecues. It was this unbelievable relief from a long, snowy winter. And there was Discovery Channel putting on Frozen Planet. Come and see some snow.
You haven't seen enough of this.
So there's little things like that make a difference.
Yeah.
So it's hard to tell. We've just aired the first episode of Seven Worlds in the US. They decided to put the Australia episode first in honour of the bushfires.
Oh.
But we haven't heard how it's gone down yet. I mean, you know, good reviews, but we'll see how the ratings are over there. But no, it's hard to predict because sometimes what works great for us isn't best over there and vice versa.
And if you're watching it in America or listening to this in America, because quite a lot of our listeners are in America, actually. Hi, everyone.
Yeah.
It's BBC America there, right?
Yeah, it's on four different channels simultaneously. So BBC America, Sundance, AMC and IFC. They're all part of the same partnership of programs. So what they're doing, because they want to make a big splash, is airing it simultaneously at 9 p.m. on those four channels every Saturday night.
Is that normal?
Right now. The multiple channels thing? It's probably not unusual in the US. It's not something that I've seen a big Attenborough show do, but mainly because they've been on either Discovery Channel exclusively. I don't think it's unusual. The whole world of cable television in the US is so murky and muddled and convoluted, and you know, there's so many channels that feed into each other, it's hard to tell.
So Lyra wanted to know, because Lyra, my daughter, who's now 8... has been watching the series, loving the series. It's nice, actually. It's the first one she's been able to watch where she hasn't been too scared by the animals killing each other.
Okay.
Which is...
because of her growing up, as opposed to us changing our palette.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. She's now watched the first Star Wars trilogy as well, the original Star Wars trilogy in full. So that's an important thing that's happened. Mm. It's not relevant, but it's true. and she wanted to know, it's a kind of a big question, how do you know when to film the animals doing the particular thing? How do you plan it all? How does it all come together?
Oh, well, that's why we're paid. paid a small amount of money. The amount of research that goes into these big series is huge. I mean, we take 3 or 4 years to make them, partly because the first 6 to 9 months is just pure research. And we're talking to scientists about how regularly an animal might do something. We're talking to people who've seen it. We might even do a scouting trip. We have to get an accurate picture of the risks involved and our chances, because we're obviously spending a lot of TV license payers' money to get this footage. So we get a good feeling of what our chances are, how often an animal might turn up, how close we could get the cameras to them, you know, what might happen. Is there a backup story if the animal doesn't do the spectacular backflip we want it to? And then obviously we're choosing camera operators who are almost obsessive in their focus. I often describe them as they're almost like assassins. They love this intensity of watching an animal and capturing the moment, because that is what they pride themselves on, whether it's cameraman, camera woman, they're pretty much the same at the top end of the game. So you're employing people who are out there who've studied animals intensely, even sometimes more than a biologist, because there's nothing like a camera operator to watch an animal and watch what they're doing and anticipate when that monkey's going to jump off the branch or when that bird's going to, you know, fart sideways or something.
And have you ever seen that happen?
Well, the camera wasn't rolling.
That's the next big season.
Exactly, yeah.
Animal flatulence.
Exactly, yeah. But yeah, so there's a lot of a lot of talent on the teams in terms of anticipating those moments, but also in the era of digital cameras and digital recording, there's a little bit of a safety net, if you like, in that we can roll cameras and know that we can delete footage. Back in the days of film, that was even more skillful, because every time you turned that camera on and you burnt through the film, it was exposed and you never got that film back. So they were a lot more anal, if you like, in terms of when they turned the cameras on, whereas we call them a shooting ratio, which is how many minutes we film in the camera compared to how many minutes go on screen. And our shooting ratios have been going up and up and up and up. And it used to be that 100 minutes of filming to 1 minute on screen, on television, was an exorbitant shooting ratio. These days, we're well beyond 400 to 1.
Oh, wow.
So as a producer-director, I have to spend 400 minutes looking through 400 minutes of, say, lion eyeball shots to get that one, find that 1 minute that would be the one I choose. But it's a slight dilemma as the director, because you, on the one hand, know that the more you shoot, the more chances you are of having those beautiful shots or those subtle moments that you'll edit together. Obviously, there's a lot of skill in the editing. And on the other hand, you know you're the sucker that's going to have to look through it all. But if, for instance, the camera operator is trying to hold focus on an animal walking through the grass towards the Jeep or something, the shallow depth of focus that we work with now in the modern cameras is so minute that to get that moment where the lion's eyeball stays in focus as it walks through the grass is really, really tricky. And so I'll generally be out there sat beside the camera operator saying, well, okay, roll if you think you need to keep trying to get it. Just because the image quality bar that we're raising with every one of these series, and everyone talks about the camera work. You know, as you guys who watch it, everyone refers us to, as a director, a producer, you're like, okay, thanks again. And the camera operators did it again. But the beauty and the skill that we put into that, into the camera capture, means that as a director, I'll suck it up and do months in the cave looking through the footage to make sure we've got those precise moments.
Do you find you can tell when you've really got a good shot, or do you kind of have to wait until you see it all back and think, oh yeah, that's actually the perfect one?
Well, often there's always this humorous, torturous, cliched moment with a wildlife film crew where you see an animal do something, like maybe it's the leopard leapt out of the tree and landed on the zebra or something, and you look at your camera operator, and they might have been hunched over the camera, and you are trying to bite your tongue off to not say, did you get that? And the camera operator is looking down the lens going, don't say, did you get that? Don't you dare say, did you get that?
They're not making eye contact.
And then you kind of look at each other and it's the camera operator that knows, because they've looked down the barrel and they know if something is pin sharp. That's the secret, if it's pin sharp. So it's generally whether they, you know, have a grin on their face. But you need to be careful about over-celebrating. You're always managing expectations with base, because you'll have bosses back at home saying, how's it going? And you'll always try and play it down and say, well, we're getting a few shots, but a lot to build on. But yeah, in the field, the team in the field usually know if you've got something special.
Yeah. What's your favourite part of a shoot, like when you're out there for weeks?
Well, it's those moments when you nail a shot. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you might be waiting a long time to see the animal or a long time for that special behaviour. But the buzz you get when it happens and the camera's rolling and you feel like you've captured it is, it's quite giddy, because most of us have gotten into this job because we love nature and we love sharing our passion for nature. That's what we want to do. So it's not just about, I've got a photo for myself. It's about, I want to show you something in the natural world that few people ever get to see. And so when you're out there and you've busted a gut and you're cold and tired and it's been weeks and nothing's worked and everyone's feeling quite broken. And then you get that moment when that polar bear leaps on the whale's back and you film this footage. It's not that you're celebrating one animal killing another, but the feeling of relief and achievement that you're going to show the world a natural phenomenon that hasn't been seen before is probably what a lot of the buzz is about, the whole job.
Yeah.
It was an amazing sequence, that, wasn't it?
It was pretty wild.
Because people will have seen you on the... Is it called? It's not called Diaries, is it?
Diaries, making of, behind the scenes.
And on that episode, we saw you where your boat got... Well, tell us what happened.
That's right. This was the North America episode.
Sorry, you're going to hear me opening the beers.
Yeah, the North America episode of Seven Worlds, One Planet, we're trying to film polar bears hunting belugas, and it was a really unusual story. We didn't actually believe it when we heard people talk about it. But in midsummer, up in Hudson Bay, there's this one location in a river mouth where certain polar bears have learnt to go and stand on boulders, and as the tide comes in and fills up around them, if they've picked just the right rock, and then they wait for beluga whales to come in, and if these beluga whales swim right beside the rock, the bear has a chance to leap on its back, give it a big bear hug, try and bite the back of its head, and try and make a kill. And it's phenomenal behavior, because a beluga whale is at least two or three times the size of a polar bear. They're one big slab of muscle. That is what a whale is. And they're in their natural element in the water, and they're slimy and slippery, and to think that a bear can actually get its legs, arms, paws around one and kill it is amazing. And so we took a gamble to go out and see if we could find it. But because this tidal range is so dangerous, it's like 16 kilometers of mudflats, and Hudson Bay, because it's shallow, gets really big storms really quick. It's treacherous for small boating because you can hit rocks all over the place and you can get stranded. And there's no lifeguard, there's no coast guard, there's no help whatsoever if you're out there and you get in trouble. We had a tiny little metal boat, and so we knew there was quite treacherous boating, and we spent a lot of time trying to find the bears, trying to spot them on the rocks, trying to get our cameras steady to film them from a distance. And sometimes we're paying so much attention to the bears that we didn't notice that we'd either run aground or come off our mooring. And this in particular instance, if you haven't seen the making of, a young polar bear was playing with our anchor and started pulling it up off the bottom of the ocean. And we thought it was kind of cute at first, watching this bear play with the anchor, forgetting that we were then adrift. And then we heard this massive bang and we realized that our metal boat had jammed on a rock and the tide was rushing out, I think. So the entire boat was stuck completely high on top of this rock. And we knew the boat would tip over, all the equipment tip over, the water is icy, there's no help there at all, and there's polar bears circling the water anyway. So some of our heroic cameramen stripped off and jumped in the water to try and manoeuvre this boat off the rock with these curious polar bears circling the boat.
Do they strip off because
they're ripped.
Yeah.
It made good telly, right?
Exactly.
They could have sold this series somehow.
Yeah, as a director, I was like, right, you leave your kit on.
But is it because then they have got dry clothes?
Well, exactly. You've got something dry to put on, yeah. And that the cameraman Sean who gets his gear off, he maintains that he absolutely hates getting cold and he hates icy water, to this day. But I don't think he minded. He might get some extra attention.
Yeah, he looked all right.
Oh, my heart was racing watching that, but I've never...
The six-pack.
Yeah, totally. I was going to say, I desperately wanted to be in that boat with you because of the polar bears, not because of the men taking their kit off. Yeah. But that must have been so exhilarating. A little part of fear, of course, but that must have been incredible.
Yeah. To be that close to polar bears, because they were coming right up to the edge of the boat and the boat's tiny and you could hear them breathing, hear their nostrils. Oh. There was one time where we were ashore having a break, lunch or something on these mudflats, and we knew there's no bears around because we looked with binoculars. And I went to have a pee and I was off near some bushes 100 metres from the crew. And we've got a guard with a gun, you've got shotguns and bear poppers, and because polar bears they're not afraid of anything and they're really curious about people and curious about food. So they are a quite dangerous animal. There's one of the very few animals that will actively hunt and stalk humans. And So when I went off to have a pee, the crew, of course, turned their back because, you know, they give me some privacy and there's no privacy out there. Yeah. And I start peeing, looking at the distant horizon, and then this white object starts emerging from the bushes. And it's a massive head. It's a massive male polar bear, and he just starts lifting his head. And I think, oh, the size of it is immense. And he's looking at me, and I kind of got stage fright. And then I'm thinking, okay, well, don't start making human noises because I know how curious they are about humans. So I start trying to whistle, thinking, oh, I got to get their attention. So I start trying to whistle, and my mouth is so dry, I can't make a whistle. And so I still got all my bits out, and I'm like trying to whistle. And because I'm looking over my shoulder, and my team won't look at me. They're 100 meters away, and it's a windy day, so they can't hear anything. They're not looking because they give me privacy. Yeah. And I turn back and think, okay, don't run. I knew that the golden rule was whatever you do, don't run, because only prey runs.
Right.
So I knew I couldn't run back to them 100 meters away. And then as I'm kind of, I'm still trying to whistle, and then I'm trying to kind of pull my trousers up, and then right beside him, another white, massive white head starts lifting up. And it was another male polar bear, a huge adult male, that lifted his head up. And it's like looking at, I don't know, two white diggers in front of you, excavators or something. They're so immense. Wow. And they both stared at me with these eyes of kind of curiosity. And I thought, okay, I'll never make it back. I either start yelling and the bears will come at me. And I thought, if I run directly at my crew, the guy with the rifle, if he's going to try and fire at the bears, he'll only have to fire over my head.
Fire you.
And I thought, well, if I run sideways, he could fire at the bears. But my God, if he doesn't hit them, then I've just run out into the wilderness to get eaten. And so all these thoughts went through my head as I kind of tried, you know, do my trousers up, and I still couldn't get there because couldn't get my crew's attention. And they stood, these two bears stood up facing me, and I thought, okay, this is it. If they're going to get me, I've got no hope at all. And they just took one look at me and thought, you know what? We know how to fish whales. They're
true.
Bigger than you. And so they just turned around and walked off over the mudflats.
Yeah.
So it's an exhilarating encounter. To be on foot with wild polar bears is quite thrilling.
And basically marking your territory.
Well, exactly. There you go. Maybe that was it.
Hello.
Yeah. Are you quite lucky to be that close to polar bears that weren't hungry?
Exactly. This is a weird summer story for polar bears, because summer is normally a time of starvation.
Yeah.
For bears, they lose about a third of their body weight. But this one small population have learnt how to hunt beluga whales from these rocks, and so they're fat and sleek and well fed. Nowhere else on the planet have I seen polar bears in summer that look as healthy and well fed as this lot. There's only one tiny group that learnt it. So yeah, I happen to be hanging out with the right group of polar bears to survive.
They were all feeding on the same whale. Is that happen?
I'm glad you spotted that, because I wanted to talk about that in the script. And when we write these scripts for David, it's really tricky to work out how much information to put in and how much to leave out, because the film is so dense with music and sound effects and visuals that it often feels like there's too many words on top. And so there's so many little bits of science that you want to get in there, so many little bits of detail that you're desperate that you could add. Mm-hmm. And one of them was this amazing fact that these polar bears share. They do not scrap. I mean, grizzly bears would be tearing each other's shoulders off over a kill. But what was happening is, no matter which bear made the kill, all of them seemed to tolerate mums coming in, cubs coming in, other males coming in. And I think it does happen in other places when people happen upon multiple polar bears eating, like a whale carcass washes up or something. But it's very rare to see it. So it's rare that you are in the right place at the right time to see polar bears sharing a meal. But it seems to be a strange thing about polar bear behaviour, is that they're very tolerant. And so we've got these amazing images after this big polar bear kills this beluga whale, where we pull out and we see all these other bears feeding at the same time. So I'm glad it struck a chord with you, because it's fascinating behaviour. And yet at that moment in the film, I've just left David with no words at all. There's too much. It just felt like too much information.
So are you writing the script then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. All the producers write the script for David.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a badge of honor to see who has the least amount of red pen from David.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that's very cool.
Because, of course, David has a pass at it, and he'll change lines to suit his talking style. And generally, you know, you're hoping that he'll make as few corrections as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Leave in your puns or your humor.
Yeah.
That's always the challenge.
Cool.
But he'll add in little Davidisms, I call them, where I had this one sequence in Planet Earth 2 of a caribou running across the tundra. And I said, the caribou, you know, wherever they go, they're followed by predators. And then it comes to a shot of an Arctic wolf. And I just said, Arctic wolves. And David wrote, he left my line, and wherever caribou go, they're followed by predators. And he wrote, and here they are, Arctic wolves.
Of course.
And it was such a Davidism. And I was like, well, I would never have written it in 100 years. But as soon as he puts it in, you're like, okay, that is his voice. You know, that's his style.
Yeah. With the polar bears, do you reckon... Oh,
can
sorry.
I just let him...
Yeah, there we go.
Crack mine open already.
For fair disclosure, I'm on a hot chocolate and spiced rum. That's how we roll in the Cosmic Ship.
I should have gone for something warm. It's not very toasty in here. But with the polar bears, with that behaviour of all of them kind of collaborating and not being bothered by each other when they might otherwise be quite territorial, do you think that's maybe a sign of the times, this kind of desperate understanding that food is scarce?
I don't think so. I don't think these animals have an understanding of the survival of their species or the survival of their group.
Mm.
No, they're tolerating strangers feeding it. I think it's probably a sign that there's that much food there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because there's an excess of whale.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I think so. It's probably just they don't need to fight to the death over that last bit of whale because one of them will catch another one.
Oh, nice.
I think, yeah. I'd love to give them more credit than that in terms of altruism, but I don't think it's the case.
So Lyra also had a question, which is the hamsters.
The hamsters? European hamsters, yeah. Aren't they great?
Yeah. How do you get close to the hamsters? Because she spent a long time teaching her guinea pigs to be okay with her being closer.
Yeah, well, a lot of the hamster sequence, this is the Europe episode, just to give viewers who hadn't, listeners who hadn't seen it a chance, it's a wonderful story where most people might not think hamsters live in the wild. We think of them as pets, but the European wild hamster is a beautiful animal, beautiful colours. And in parts of Vienna, Austria, they go to graveyards where they like to eat the flowers. People put down fresh flowers all the time on the graves. And so the hamsters are attracted to eat the fresh flowers. So we'd heard about this story. You can't get too close to them. Most of it is shot on a very, very long lens. So the cameraman might be 20, 30 metres away, waiting for the hamsters to come out of the forest and go up to the graves and nick flowers. So it was a traditional long lens, don't get too close to them story. But what was so funny was they also liked eating candle wax because it had oils in it. And so they put their head into glass jars, the glass candles that people put on the graveyards. And they're filling their cheek pouches, and their cheek pouches become so huge and engorged that they can't get their head back out of the jar, and they the last thing they want to do is give up on all the wax they've eaten, so they get this head stuck in a jar, and they're thrashing their head around in this glass jar, and it really is absolutely comic gold.
Love it. In this series, more than probably most of them, certainly the ones that came a while back, that we're seeing more of cities and we're seeing more of people. Is that a conscious decision?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think it's part of the evolution of these big glossy Attenborough shows, is that we have to talk more about how nature fits in with humanity. I sometimes compare, we go back to Planet Earth, the original, which is only 13 years old now. There's not one single word about conservation in that entire series. 11 hours, some of you might remember it, 11-part series, and not one single line about the environment. And what's even more, that's remarkable, and what's even more remarkable than that is guess how many complaints we had from viewers or TV critics. That was a trick question. It was a big fat zero.
Yeah.
Not one single person on the planet. And that DVD is owned by more humans than any other DVD on the planet.
Wow.
So more households had Planet Earth, the original DVD box set, than any other DVD. And yet we got zero complaints. No one 13 years ago thought that it mattered that a big glossy series didn't mention the environment. But it shows you how much society's changed and how much the zeitgeist has changed.
So the complaints you're getting now are that you're not mentioning it enough?
Well, no, I think we've responded to the times, and I think what we've seen since then is Frozen Planet had a dedicated climate change episode at the end, Africa had a dedicated environment show, The Hunt had a dedicated conservation show. So we've been tacking it on a little bit more, and then I think with something like Planet Earth 2, we added the cities episode and talked a bit more about how cities are the fastest growing habitat on the planet, and we need to address the fact that the world isn't pristine jungles and mountains anymore. And I feel like with Blue Planet 2 took another big step forward, Our Planet, the Netflix series, which wasn't made by the BBC, but I think you'd put it in this basket, obviously, this evolution. Every single episode had some kind of environmental message in the script. And with Seven Worlds, we made sure that every single episode had an environmental story, a story about conservation. And so I feel like it now it would be unacceptable for us not to weave it into the fabric of the shows. And that is great that over a decade now, you know, the environment is so important and so much on people's minds. For a long time, I mean, we used to call it the C word, but which was conservation in our episodes. Our commissioners and bosses in London often didn't want to put conservation in these big glossy Attenborough series. It's like, well, if we're going to do conservation, we'll do it as a BBC Four spin-off, or it'll be somewhere buried in the TV schedule. And so I think the BBC is not the only TV channel that's woken up more to the fact that people want to see this stuff. For a long time, we thought that it was a major put-off. What a lot of people don't realise about natural history filmmaking is that the vast majority of viewers come to it for escapism and entertainment.
Yeah.
They don't actually come to it really to be educated, or certainly not to be preached at. If you can slip those messages in, great. And a lot of us who care a lot about the environment think, no, surely that's not the case. Surely we all want Attenborough to talk about conservation issues. But I assure you that the vast majority of our viewers don't. They want to forget about the day job they're doing on Monday morning. They want to be taken to another place, another world, and have that escapism. So there's always been this, caution from the commissioning level in the BBC about putting conservation into these big escapist, glossy series and the risk of turning off viewers. Even as producers and biologists ourselves, we've been fighting to get the message in, but I think finally now it's accepted that we couldn't leave it out now. And viewers aren't turning away, you know, they want to. But it's a balance. It's always about trying to find how many minutes of it can you have in one episode before you get so depressed you'd reach for the remote.
Yeah, how do you find that line? At what point do you, when you're writing the script, say, okay, this might be getting a little bit too preachy now, or I don't want to detract from the amazing visuals of this wildlife.
It's hard. We talk about it as a team a lot. On each of the seven continents for Seven Worlds, some producers might have been finding some slightly more interesting conservation stories than others. But I think we thought that at least one big, strong conservation story per episode was needed. If you can weave the message in seamlessly elsewhere, fantastic. If you can talk about a rare animal and why it's endangered, then fantastic. It's also a little bit about where you put it in the film. I think if you opened your opening minutes with deforestation or chainsaws, or the Asia episode, for instance, has some very emotional scenes of the orangutans being darted and hitting bulldozers, and it's you know, utterly depressing to learn about the palm oil situation. If you open the Asia episode with that, you know, a lot of people wouldn't be how they'd want to spend a Sunday night. So, yeah, it's about finding the right balance. And I think every time we do one of these series, there'll be people who say there isn't enough conservation in there, and there'll be other people already saying, oh God, I'm finding it a bit too heavy. Mm. So, yeah, it's tough.
Because you've got this films like The Cove and Blackfish and things, which are very much
harrowing.
But a lot of people watch them.
Well, the thing that they've got going for them, I mean, besides the message, and we want people to see it, is story. And that's the thing our commissioners would always say to us, as, you know, here in Bristol, we're wildlife biologists and we would love to put more conservation in, and we're desperately sad about watching the natural world we're trying to film disappear before our very eyes. Our commissioners are TV people. You know, they might be one day talking about reality TV and the next day thinking about, I don't know, some dancing show. So they don't quite have the same amount of sympathy, you know, for an orangutan in the rainforest as we do. And so they generally have a filter of what makes good television and what will keep viewers involved. It can be important. They often want us to be topical, not timeless. I think traditionally we often make these big Attenborough shows, we make them feel timeless, but not quite topical enough. And it's hard when you make them over 4 years. Like the Australian bushfires are horrific the last few months, but we'd finished filming in Australia 6 months ago, so we couldn't weave that story in. But I think if you can find a way that makes the story engaging and captivating and hooks people in, then you can get the message across. I think if I tried to pitch a film to the BBC and say, I want to do a film called deforestation, the tree murderers or something. Any TV boss would say, okay, well, how many people are going to start watching that?
Yeah.
Whereas I think the success of films like Virunga was another good one. If you saw that on Netflix, an amazing film that Leonardo DiCaprio executive produced. But the story of these guys going undercover to follow the poaching of these mountain gorillas, and the way that unfolded was like a Hollywood drama. Mm. And so I think it's if you've got intrigue or story or balance, there are ways of getting that message across. But I think partly the problem with environmental messaging, and Emma, you probably face this all the time, partly is if you put your stall out and just say, well, today is all about how depressing plastic is, it's not exactly, we use this word in television called the invitation. You know, we're always talking about what is the invitation to the viewer. Mm. And so that is a challenge, is trying to find ways that make the environmental message comes out, but the story is kind of intriguing. Like in North America, for instance, in Seven Worlds, we had a beautiful sequence of manatees wandering through the swamps in Florida. And I wanted to use these shots. I got this cameraman to pull out. We had a drone lifting up, and wanted him to pull out, to start with the manatees in the water, and pull out to reveal the fact that right beside them was a speedboat, and then another speedboat, and then a house, and then a car, and a road. And as you pulled up and got higher and higher, it was mind-blowing to look at these manatees that you thought were in this wild swamp for 5 minutes. All of a sudden you're like, oh my God, they're literally in a suburban canal. And so I could have started with that, but the power of as a storyteller, trying to find a way to weave that in is, you know, what we're always looking for.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I was also on Twitter having an argument with some guy.
Twitter's good for that.
Yeah. So what's that rule on the internet that you're not supposed to look at the comments? That's what Twitter is, right? It's just the comments. So don't look at Twitter. And but he was saying, oh, here you go again, making these wildlife. I think it was Liz Bonin had made a programme, Plastics.
Yeah. Mm.
And he was saying, oh, here you go again, travelling around the world, ruining the world, making the programmes. And, well, I want you to respond to that, because my response to that is clearly, well, think about the good that they're doing.
Well, exactly, exactly. I mean, every single thing you do on the planet has a footprint. You know, the fact that we're sitting here breathing at each other means we're emitting carbon dioxide. I mean, I'm breathing on you less than you are on me, but that's it's breathing. But everything we do has a footprint. And I think I always say that with conservation and environmental messaging, you're not going to get far if all it is suppression. If all you're doing is telling modern society, okay, stop doing this now, switch off your light bulbs now, stop driving your car now, it will just fall on deaf ears. We have to come up with alternatives, and we have to, humans often learn through the back pocket, and humans, you know, we're a slightly faulty species in that sense, but you've got to accept human nature and accept that preaching and righteousness and stuff is, it might, you know, change you and your friends of your little greeny gang, but it's not going to have a that great a reach. And so we have to accept that everything we do has a footprint. Some of us need to drive to work. Some of us need to fly to work. I mean, I have to get on a plane every time I go to film a polar bear. You know, do we try and keep our teams to a skeleton size? Every decision we make about our footprint weighs on us, and we think about it and weigh it up. But for us, the thought of getting the footage out there and showing people that message obviously balances it out, that footprint. And so I think it's always a glib argument to say, well, you know, this money could have been spent on a hospital, or this could have been done in a different way. I think, you know, David Attenborough is often fond of saying it's about not squandering things. But I think we could all make small decisions about how better to live. What I sometimes worry about with environmental messaging, and you might find this too, is that I find that some people get too focused on the personal nitty-gritty, I've got to recycle my plastic cups at home, thinking that there's this old adage of act locally, think globally, or whatever it was. And I think it's slightly been a little bit misleading, because I think it's, if I'm talking to, say, a school about recycling or environmental messaging, I'll often say, okay, well, let's try and work out how many minutes of a year we all spent recycling in our homes, and we try and make this calculation. And then I'll often try and ask an audience, okay, how many minutes of a year did anyone spend writing to your MP or writing to a corporation? Because the power is with politics and corporate power. You know, that is where the change will happen. And I just feel like if we address that more and go to, like, if you get on social media and you tweet a high street brand, a high street supermarket, and say, you know, "Oi, Tesco, Sainsbury's, I wish you'd use this plastic. I'm going to go shop at Morrison's because they said they will." That's out there in the public, and they're tagged. And that's the kind of way that you make corporations change their behavior. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be doing stuff at home, but I think it's just been, it's been a slight neoliberalism con, this the individual has to do everything. And I think it's slightly detracted from the fact that we have to take on the big players. And not in a big way. It's not like you need to, I mean, Greta Thunberg's an absolute hero, but it's not that you need to be outside the steps of Parliament with your placard. But the amount of minutes it would take to tweet a big corporate chain, or to tweet an oil company, or to write to your MP is a fraction of the amount of time we spend recycling our newspapers at home. Yeah. And so I think that's kind of where I'd...
Greta Thunberg, because she was around, I've been trying to ignore the news because of Brexit.
No, yeah.
Oh, God. Boris Johnson and that one in America. So I kind of, she was around for a while before I noticed, and then everyone started talking to me about it, and I was like, "What's she doing?" And they say, "Oh, she's great. She talks about this stuff." And I'm like, "Yeah, we've been talking about that for ages. Why?" And then I saw her and I was like, "Oh, I get it."
Yeah, her messaging is so powerful.
It's brilliant.
So powerful.
And to have someone so young as well, and she's a real illustration of, it's kind of proof that the youth are politically charged and they do have these real concerns. And I just think she's a really good beacon for cross generations and just...
I
feel sorry for her in a way, because the pressure on her shoulders must be so immense. And she's incredible, and I'd, you know, love to shake her hand one day, but I personally couldn't handle that at all. I am amazed by how she's managed to unite people of all across the world, of all backgrounds, all generations, for this kind of one overarching goal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's partly her personality.
Yeah.
I mean, she's iron-willed and has a steel to her that a lot of us... don't, you know, a lot of us would break under the pressure she's under. But yeah, what an absolute hero.
Absolutely brilliant. You should get her on For What It's Earth.
Oh yeah, I'll tweet her. Me and my massive following will get her on my tiny little podcast. She's up there on the list of dream guests. Yeah, her and David Attenborough are the two I'm lobbying for at the moment.
Well, if you ever meet anyone who knows him, you know, ask.
Okay.
Yeah, if you could just set that up. That would be great. My dream is just to have him say the words, "Hello and welcome to For What It's Earth," and just use that at the top of every podcast. I would die happy.
Okay.
That would
We do joke about the fact that we've recorded every single word in the dictionary with David, and we could cut them together.
Yeah. Excellent. I will be following up on that.
Who you need to befriend first is Cassette Boy.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Just befriend Cassette Boy, and there you go.
That's a good idea. That's right. So what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on fatherhood.
Ah,
I'm actually taking a break.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
My second baby was born 24 hours before Seven Worlds came on air, so the timing was perfect, so I'm having a bit of a break. Cool. There's a lot going on at the BBC. Planet Earth 3 is already in production. There's a big series called Green Planet, which is obviously all about plant stories, which will be amazing. I mean, the things that the plant world does, which we don't know about, phenomenal. Frozen Planet 2 is in production.
Wow.
So generally, often we don't talk about these things. They're hush-hush. Mm. But with the other streaming giants getting involved, I think the BBC, well, we want to kind of remind the world that the Planet brand really is ours. You know, we did Planet Earth first, and we're still doing it.
Because last time you were here talking about Planet Earth 2, and you sort of hinted strongly that Blue Planet 2 was...
Oh, we did, that's right, we dropped the... If you haven't heard it here, viewers, then Planet Earth 3 is on its way.
Yeah, but it's interesting how it's changed, that, you know, now it's like, just to talk about it, it's kind of okay.
Changes
in the wildlife filmmaking.
It's kind of a reflection of the change in the television industry. You know, are we all going to end up just paying for what we view? Will iPlayer become a Netflix? It's no secret that the BBC are removing all of their content from Netflix, because obviously we want iPlayer to be a place that people come to.
Yeah.
So if the BBC, if we could get our act together and make it happen, but, you know, one day we might, I might be fired for saying this, but we might see iPlayer become a global subscription service, and there's a lot of people around the world that love BBC content.
Mm.
No TV channel in the world has more content than the BBC. You think about the back catalogue of Doctor Who's and Monty Python's and you name it. And the world loves it. The world has loved British television for decades, and most of it's come from the BBC. So instead of us putting it out to Netflix, you know, might be that the BBC becomes a streamer as well.
Mm.
But it's a really fluid market at the moment, with things like Disney Plus coming along and Apple wanting you to buy content directly from them. It's going to be a very crowded marketplace for our money. You know, how many families are going to be able to afford
7 different
services? Well, exactly. To be able to pay for Netflix monthly, Disney Plus monthly, the other ones.
So there's BritBox, right?
That's the BBC and ITV collaborating to. Have we started paying for BritBox yet?
I haven't. I don't know if it's.
I should know.
But. Yeah. I don't. I mean, it seems like that's going to be where it's going to go. Because I watched it. Even though it was on telly, at the time I was watching it, I watched Seven Worlds, One Planet on iPlayer because it was in Ultra HD.
Oh, nice.
On iPlayer.
Oh.
So.
Did you notice it?
I don't know because I wasn't comparing it, but it looked brilliant.
Yeah,
so.
good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really want to say this on the podcast because I don't want them to hear it.
He's going to say it anyway, isn't he?
But I would totally subscribe to BBC iPlayer. Like, of course I would.
Yeah. I think a lot of people around the world would.
But I'd rather just do it as a license fee.
Yeah. It's
going to be my point. Yeah. It's like, are we not already paying?
I know. Well, no. It wouldn't be a place of.
Oh, okay.
A place of the TV license fee. The problem with the TV license fee is it's only Brits who are paying it.
Mm.
So it completely shackles the BBC in terms of being a global player.
True.
And so it people keep asking why we don't put more stuff on the internet. And the problem is that because it's you guys here in the UK, you've paid for it. Yeah. So we can't put a lot of stuff out because, oh, hang on, it's on the internet. Well, the Americans haven't paid for it.
Mm.
So I'd love to see a day where the license fee is gone entirely. Because I think it needs to be opened up to the rest of the world. Yeah. Like the world loves BBC content and it trickles out to different regions, but there's this weird anachronism that the British public are paying this TV license, and it should, the fact that it stands out proud as a separate fee feels like it just draws a lot of attention to itself. I mean, it should be, you know, should be absorbed in income tax and come out of a government stream, except not every government is that supportive of the BBC. You know, it's hard times to keep. You know, you need the public to believe in public broadcasting, and it's hard when a lot of the attackers would love to see the end of the BBC. But anyway,
so we should probably end because it's really cold in the shed. But it's been wonderful. I want to ask you what you watch.
Well, I'm a sci-fi nut. Yeah, so I like escapism. I find natural history hard to watch, wildlife films, because it's so much like homework.
Mm.
I love a good riveting documentary, but it has to be a story that is hard to believe. I think what I normally do is when it gets to the Oscars, and we're in Oscar season right now, so perfect. I look at the nominations for best documentary, and without fail, I've never heard of one of them. And without fail, every single one of them is brilliant.
Yeah.
And it's just an example of a place that you can, you know, find films that are amazing stories, you know, riveting storytelling. You learn something from them.
You know, Storyville is the.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, like, they could make a film about this shed and I'd watch it, you know.
Yes, yeah.
I would watch that.
No, I've never come across a Storyville that I haven't enjoyed. Yeah. Brilliant. Quite a few of those have been nominated for Oscars and probably some won. Yeah.
I've always been really curious. When you're on the shoot, I mean, obviously, when you watch wildlife programs, there's always fantastic, amazing sound, even though, like you said, you're often quite a long way away from the animal in question. Is that all? Do you do that all afterwards? Do you use Foley artists? Do you do sound recording beforehand?
No, a lot of it is recorded separately.
Mm.
I will confess. We do everything we can to record as much wild sound as possible. Take out booms and shotgun mics.
Yeah.
So much of the action happens so far away, we cannot get those sounds. Yeah. So if you're watching a lion-buffalo battle, it might have been shot 100 metres away because we need to use our telephoto lenses. Mm. we can't put those feet splashing in the mud and those growls on. We can't record them from that distance. Mm. So a lot of them have to be attached later. And it is often not quite a dirty secret, but I think most viewers forgive us because what we're trying to do is to make the scene as accurate as possible and as real as possible. So everything we do with sound is to make it as absolutely true to nature and true to that moment as it was.
Mm.
And sometimes we have to bend the rules a bit and take liberties, but there's a lot of sound layering that we have to do afterwards to make it as realistic as possible.
No, and brilliant. It sometimes gets us into trouble. It adds to the experience, amazingly, like especially when you hear like a squelch or something.
It's interesting though because it does divide people. Each producer director is different, so you might watch a series like Seven Worlds and notice that through different episodes, the sound design is either richer or a bit more creative than other times. I try to keep it quite subdued and quite natural. But you can really take it to the nth degree of, you know, fungus growing in the rainforest in time-lapse. Yeah. All sorts of squelching could be put on that when you're watching the TV show and it feels right.
Mm.
But, of course, in time-lapse, you can't hear anything.
No.
And a mushroom growing, of course, you can't hear anything.
No. And it's not like you can put a lav mic on a lion or anything, is it?
So. Yeah. We do sometimes some really little effects that we use just to create something quite subliminal for the viewer. So in Planet Earth 2, we had a harvest mouse run along a bramble branch past a big thorn. Yeah. And a harvest mouse is tiny, the size of
a harvest
walnut
mouse.
Yes. And it ran past this big bramble thorn, and the sound editor put the sound of swords swishing on it. Ooh. Very subtly. It's the kind of whoosh sound, the unmistakable metal-on-metal sound that you might hear in a sword fight as its leg ran past. And you'll never have noticed it.
No.
It's incredibly subtle, but it just was another. It's just a little example of the polish and the structure that we create, the sound design we use and the music we use, and everything is creating something so rich and thick. And you sit there at home watching it and just let it, you know, it washes over you.
Mm.
Same with a Hollywood film. You know, we sit there and watch our favourite sci-fi and this could explode or lasers go here and we're following story and it's great to watch. But the detail that goes into it is phenomenal. Mm. You know, years of crafting. So, yeah, our sound takes that much crafting as well.
Well, I mean, that's how you know it's done right, because you don't notice it. You would notice it if it had been done really badly.
Yeah. Yeah.
My favourite one from sci-fi is the TIE fighter in Star Wars, obviously. Is there anybody who listens to Cosmic Shadow who
doesn't know a TIE fighter?
Piece of information.
Yes. Well, which generation TIE fighter?
The first generation was, I believe it was a lorry driving through a puddle combined with and slowed down and combined with a elephant trumpeting.
Oh, fantastic. Oh,
what a combination.
Why would you do that?
I know. Well, the sound guys get to just mess around with sounds. And the good thing about sci-fi is they probably get to mess around with all sorts of things in their own cosmic shed and say, hey, boss, what do you think about this sound? What do you think about this sound? This could be like the, jet fighter or that kind of that lightsaber or something. Because there's one where they had beard trimmers, and they put their arm inside a metal tube and they were rolling their beard trimmer around inside the metal tube where the microphone was, and I think it became one of the spaceships in Star Wars.
Wow.
Brilliant.
Whereas we can't do that with wildlife. We're not exactly sitting there with beard trimmers and pipes and things saying, well, what could this be? You know, another thing I loved about the latest Star Wars is that whole desert planet, I forget what it was called, but was filmed in an area of Jordan called Wadi Rum.
Oh, I've been there. It's gorgeous.
Yes, having made a series called Wild Arabia, you know, we filmed on all those rocks, and so every view there was, I was in the geeking out on different angles.
I've seen beetles there. You've got a really nice night sky there.
Yeah, okay, so there you go. So you've got to see the latest Star Wars because you'll geek out. And they stay on this desert planet for a long time, but it is just beautifully shot in Jordan.
Oh, okay.
Have you even seen it, Amber?
No, I'm so sorry. It's on my list.
Yeah, no, it got it.
Jordan or the Star Wars?
Hmm?
You've seen all the others?
No. I've seen the oldest one.
Is this the eject button?
I know.
Well, Star Wars does do justice to the deserts of Jordan.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's good.
I'll report back when I've seen it.
There you go.
I would just like to say thank you again for making this wonderful television series. And thank you for not getting eaten by polar bears.
Yeah. Thanks for watching.
We couldn't not watch. That we started the podcast with some person from the New York Times who's watched too much wildlife stuff and got a bit complacent. And they're wrong.
Right? Yeah, yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Welcome to the comment section again.
Yeah. If anybody's listening who's thinking, I love all that stuff, and I'd just like to do something to help, you could listen to For What It's Earth.
Thank you. So every week we look at a different topic, something to do with the environment or climate or sustainability, and we break that topic down, whether it's plastics, fast fashion, palm oil, as you've mentioned before. We talk about the topic itself, the causes of the issues, what needs to be done big picture, and then what those of us at home listening can do so that we don't feel totally powerless as well. So whether that's, as you said, writing to an MP or using our consumer purchasing power to change our habits, or literally just changing one little thing in our lives.
It's great. It is a great podcast. I do bang on about it a bit. Okay. It is very, very good.
Thank you.
When you write to your MP, if I wrote to my MP, she'd just write back and go, yeah, I know, because she's great. She knows what she's doing.
Oh.
So I want to write to someone else's MP.
Oh, see, yeah.
Can I write to Jacob Rees-Mogg? He's nearly here.
He's not far.
Write to him. I don't think he'd listen. Anyway.
Yeah.
Chadden, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you.
In the Cosmic Shed.
Thanks for inviting me back to the shed.
Oh, love it in here. And Emma, thank you. Yeah, we just have to get you here in the summer. I mean, it's much nicer in the summer.
The problem is our big Attenborough shows always come out in the winter.
Yeah.
Don't they?
Yeah.
I don't know, I think that they add something kind of more edgy to the shed.
Yeah.
You know, it feels it's cold in space.
Yeah, we've endured it.
Exactly. You know,
it's like a badge of honour.
Yeah. We've intergalactic.
We've shedded in the winter.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to sit in a cold shed in winter, but you do get to be part of these big David Attenborough shows.
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, swings around.
Exactly.
But, yes, thank you very much. And thank you very much for listening. We'll be back soon with an episode about something, but I don't know what. Oh, yeah. There's a wonderful book called Dark Skies. And it's about, I think, walking in nature underneath the skies. So we're going to be talking about that.
Right.
Pretty cool. Yeah.
Right, let's go look at Orion.
Yeah, let's do it. See if it's exploded.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.
I'm a recorder and he's brought this up.
Oh, the pipe's gone broken in the Cosmic Shed. Oh. It seems to... Chewie, see if you can lock that down.